What I want to do now is finish up the discussion of what I have called emancipatory social science, within which then the Marxist tradition constitutes one of the most powerful threads. It's not the only way of doing emancipatory social science, but I think it's really the most developed and comprehensive, and it constitutes a theoretical tradition that other forms of emancipatory social science really have to attend to. So if you're really serious, for example, as a feminist and wanting to develop a emancipatory social science of gender oppression, to do so and to ignore the connection between gender and class and the Marxian tradition is really a mistake. You know, it's just a mistake because it's a rich source of ideas that would inform any current of emancipatory theory. All right, so let's return to that theme. This is then in the current outline at the top, Roman numeral 4. There are 4 tasks of any emancipatory theory or social science. First, a clarification of normative foundations. What are the moral purposes that drive the theory? Second, the diagnosis and critique of the world as it exists in light of those moral foundations. Third, envisioning viable alternatives. I've emphasized the word viable there, but alternatives need to be, as we will discuss, they need to be evaluated on 3 terms: their desirability, viability, and achievability. The desirability of alternatives asks how well do they conform to those normative foundations. And the achievability criteria asks, with respect to the 4th task, what kind of transformations are possible to get to those alternatives. Viability is the distinctive problem of alternatives then. It's the part of the discussion of alternatives that's really located in that task. Desirability and achievability connect alternatives to 2 other tasks in this quartet of tasks of emancipatory social theory. And finally, the 4th task is a theory of transformation. First, one general comment. Most radical theorists, critical theorists, emancipatory social theorists of all sorts, mostly they actually focus on the 2nd of these. I mean, just think about the vast scholarship in feminist sociology, cultural studies, etc., that we've seen over the last 3 decades or so. Most of what's done by feminist sociologists is diagnosis and critique of the world as it is. It's identifying the forms of male domination, of gender inequality, of gender domination, how it works, how it's reproduced, the harms it generates, the variations that exist. But mostly, feminists don't spend a lot of time discussing the normative foundations. They take them for granted. Gender equality, or some variant on gender equality, is just taken for granted as a justifiable goal. And mostly, they don't spend a lot of time talking about alternatives. They don't ask the question, what kind of structures would really eliminate gender inequality, and are they viable? You're very hard put to find a discussion among feminists of the possibility that gender inequality could never be a stable form of social organization. Now, among Marxists, you find that kind of discussion all the time. You know, Marxists are incredibly anxious. They worry about the question, is it actually possible to eliminate class domination? Would a world of without those kinds of inequalities, without class domination, would it be stable? Indeed, since the experiences of the 20th century, Marxists asked the question, what do we actually mean by socialism, and could it actually stably reproduce itself? There's a lot of anxiety about the nature of the alternative and its conditions of existence. That anxiety doesn't exist in feminism. That's around this 3rd task. We'll talk about that in one of the sessions in a month or so when we talk about class and gender, about why is it that the problem of class emancipation poses such difficult questions about the nature of the alternative, whereas the question of gender emancipation doesn't. Gender emancipation doesn't pose the same problems. Now, maybe it should. I mean, here's a scenario in which gender emancipation leads to the destruction of humanity, right? What would happen, what suppose it is the case, so this is a hypothetical, that under really radical egalitarian gender relations, you have demographic collapse, because there simply are not enough babies produced. That is, under conditions of inequality, a small proportion, rather than most, women decide that they want to have children. Under the, I don't believe this. I think there are reasons for having children that are deeply part of the human condition in the most positive and life-affirming kind of way, and that the raising and bringing into the world of children under egalitarian conditions will be done with even more enthusiasm than under inegalitarian conditions. But it's not an incoherent argument to imagine, especially if you take a kind of hyper-individualistic view as to what gender emancipation means, that if you really created a world where each person has full autonomy and self-determination under fully egalitarian conditions, where there are no gender expectations about roles for men and women, that is, there's no socially inscribed, enforced role expectations about what it means to be a woman versus a man. Because if there are those expectations, that implies that there's a certain form of coercive social pressure on people to be a certain kind of way. So one could imagine that that could lead to demographic collapse. Well, that would be the equivalent for gender equality. What people say about class equality, that in the absence of class inequalities, there would be such a collapse of the incentive structures for people to take risks, to invest, to engage in productive economic activity under a purely egalitarian conditions, that you'd have economic collapse. You know, that's the conservative critique of anti-capitalist possibilities. Okay, well, that's the discussion of the viability of alternatives, which is particularly salient in the class analytic currents of emancipatory social theory. Let me then just briefly make some comments about each of these main topics. Some of them we'll be spending a lot of time in the course of the semester. Diagnosis and critique will occupy a lot of what we're talking about, and the theory of transformation occupies a lot of what we'll be talking about. So what I'd like to now say a little bit more about the normative foundation, since we don't talk a lot about that during the semester, and a little bit about the problem of alternatives. First, normative foundations. So one thing to note in the Marxist tradition is that there's, for a long time, Marxists actually rejected the relevance of talking about moral issues. The idea of social justice, for example, as an explicit topic of concern, was often seen as a kind of diversion from what's important. What this reflects is the following, that there are really two grounds on which you can argue against capitalism. One is that it's unjust. It violates a variety of moral principles, which can be subsumed under the notion of social justice. This is an unjust system. But the other thing you can just simply say is it harms certain people. It's against the interests of some people. Irrespective of whether it's just or unjust, it simply harms certain people. We can make that distinction clearly. So, for example, in a different arena, we have citizenship rules in the world where we divide humanity into people who are citizens of a country and people who are not, right? The whole immigration debate is all about that. We have national borders and we don't have free movement of people. And even when people move, they don't get the full rights of membership of a country just by being there. Now, we can clearly say having strong citizenship rules is in the interests of some people and harms the interests of others. That's a clean statement. You don't need any moral grounding for that. It just harms them. Their lives would go better if they could become citizens. Their lives go worse because they can't. It's a completely separate matter whether you think it's justified to deny people citizenship. By some accounts, it's unjust because the accident of birth shouldn't determine your life chances. It's a random, arbitrary fact that you happen to be born on one side of a border rather than another side of a border. You bear no responsibility for where you're born, and things over which you have no responsibility shouldn't determine your life prospects in a just world. So people can say it's unfair that you can't be a citizen, but it's in my interest to prevent you from doing so. That's the, I think, correct way of thinking about the problem. And then you can decide whether the justice considerations or the interest considerations ought to be the grounds on which you argue over such things as citizenship. Well, Marxists have always traditionally taken the position that the grounds on which to criticize capitalism is simply that it's in the interests of workers to have an alternative. Their lives would go better in an alternative to capitalism. Capitalism harms the working class. And more broadly, it harms the masses of the population. And it's the harms of capitalism, that is, it violates their interests, that is, are the grounds for criticizing it. Not that it's unjust. You don't have to make an argument about libertarian property rights and, you know, Lockean and other views about natural rights and all that stuff. All you have to do is say which system would be better, and the vast majority of people would be better off in an alternative, and that's grounds enough to argue for an alternative. And that's not an unreasonable position to take. However, I think in the world in which we live, it's unsatisfactory from the view of the theory of transformation to argue simply on the grounds of interests. And the reasons for this is that it is simply not the case that the coalition of people for whom capitalism is unequivocally harmful is large enough and powerful enough that it has prospects of transforming capitalism without bringing into the coalition of struggle people who are doing okay in capitalism, in which the prospects of how well things will go in an alternative are uncertain, but for whom they would have strong moral objections to the way capitalism treats people. The problem is that workers don't have the power to overthrow capitalism, and in general, the oppressed are dominated without sufficient power to act in their to realize their interests. This is why, in fact, I think it's crucial that in the mobilization and in the ideological battles over capitalism, the moral issues around this form of economic structure compared to alternatives be brought to the fore. People, so there are, I guess, two big arguments here as to why moral normative foundation. I mean, this may be belaboring a point that this is maybe an example of my personal history of having argued with certain Marxist currents about the importance of moral considerations means that I hammer on this point why we need moral considerations, whereas for most of you, duh, it's obvious you have to take moral considerations seriously. So I may be beating a dead horse here. But let me still continue to beat it for a few more minutes. There are two reasons then why I think we need an account of the moral reasons for a diagnosis and critique of capitalism, not just the harms that it imposes on certain groups of people. First, people are in fact motivated by moral concerns, not just their direct interests. Justice and considerate concerns about justice are really part of our subjective constitution as human beings. We are homo moralis, if you will, not just homo economicus. Moral sentiments can be mobilized for purposes of social transformation. There is compassion for the downtrodden, and there are identity-based moral concerns as well. It is often a combination of these that creates the strongest commitments for social change. So to reject a serious engagement with the normative foundations for a critique of capitalism is to just disarm yourself from one of the crucial ways that people mobilize for sacrifice. They do so for moral reasons, not just for interest reasons. And so that's true even for workers. That's true even for those who will benefit most from an alternative. The motivation to make the sacrifices to achieve the alternative, the motivations for that, are significantly reinforced when they are backed by a sense of moral commitment, that this is the right thing to do, not just the self-interested thing to do. And secondly, as I've already alluded, social justice arguments are a way of building coalitions and alliances. You can bring more people into the struggle by bringing people who are not as severely harmed by existing institutions, but feel that they are unfair and harmful to others. These are the reasons then to bring moral concerns to bear on the diagnosis and critique of the society. Both of these reasons, however, create their own problems. So there are downsides to emphasizing moral commitment. Moral commitments are often deeply connected to emotional states, and these can underwrite rigid thinking. So this is a really complicated matter, and it involves understanding moral psychology, not just moral philosophy or social movements. The rage and anger that can be bonded with moral conviction can fuel what is sometimes called the true believer problem. Cognitive understanding gets blocked by moral passion. And you get rigid forms of thinking that get kind of welded together through this complex combination of moral passion, cognitive rigidity, and sort of ideological certainty that can become a disabling form of thinking with respect to the tasks of social change. Yeah?
Just a quick question, not to interrupt. Do the moral considerations also problems for the issue of desirability?
Well, they are meant to
help it.
To strengthen it. They can create moral blinders, you know. The fact of the matter is that we live in a world of very complex trade-offs between different values. You can't maximize, if you have four values you really care about, it's utterly implausible that you can maximize on all four. There are trade-offs. And this moral rigidity that often comes along with moral passion makes people unwilling to compromise, unwilling to see the trade-offs, and that gets in the way of social mobilization and social change. So that's one of the issues, this kind of emotional rigidifying of the intellectual frameworks within which we engage in social change. And secondly, the complexity of conflicting legitimate moral claims. There can be social justice on both sides of a conflict. Social justice arguments can push political dynamics towards more flexibility and a desire for compromise because competing social change can all seem as having legitimacy. So this can create a space for compromises, and not just based on a balance of power or force. This is an issue that we will discuss in a few weeks when we talk about positive class compromise rather than negative class compromise. But of course, this makes for much more complex politics. if you have to recognize the legitimacy of claims of others because you are morally sensitive, if you realize there can be social justice claims on both sides of an argument, rather than social justice claims become absolutes, well, that makes things more complicated. I think a very good context where this occurs, one of the most painful in the world, is around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because unequivocally, the Palestinian cause is just, in my view. It's a European-backed colonial incursion of a settler state that has displaced people. That's true. On the other hand, people have lived there for three generations now. They are as much have their lives embedded in that place as anybody else. And it would be unjust also to deny them a place. You have conflicting social justice claims. Similar to the issue with indigenous peoples everywhere, Native Americans in the United States, Aboriginal indigenous people in Australia. Unequivocally, they were displaced from the land. But it would also be unjust to simply say, yes, that was theft. You have a right to it, and you have a right to full compensation for the land that was taken from you at current market values. I mean, that would destroy the economy of the United States and displace millions of people from their homes. Right? You know, it would just be an impossible, it would be an impossible situation. There are social justice issues because of the living people whose lives are bound up in the consequences of past injustices. And you can't simply undo them, and that means you have to figure it out. And figuring things out like that involve compromises, and they're difficult. So bringing these moral issues to bear complicates things. The simple interest arguments, this is in my interests, I'm going to serve my interests, and if I end up with the power to enforce them and you end up weak enough to be defeated, so be it. Well, that's a simpler view of the world. But I think it's ultimately a disabling view of the world. Okay. I said I was going to spend about 20 minutes on this whole thing. That was spending about 15 minutes just on this one point. All right, let's march forward a little more efficiently. Let's see, let me get my outline here. Okay, there are three principles which I now work with in analyzing these issues. This is a little different from the way it's framed in Envisioning Real Utopia in the readings. I've kind of developed some of these ideas further. Three clusters: equality and fairness, democracy and freedom, and community and solidarity. So let me just briefly state what each of these is. Equality and fairness. In a just society, all persons would have broadly equal access to the material and social means. Whoops. Let's turn this off. Sorry. I hope I didn't, as a result of